Togaden was waiting for him in the towering ante-hall behind the strategium. "There you are," he grinned. "Here I am," Logan agreed. "There will be a question," Togaden remarked, keeping his voice low. "It will not be obviously directed to you, but be ready to catch it." Logan didn't like the sound of Torgadon's words, but he appreciated the warning. He followed Torgadon down the length of the ante-hall. It was a perilously tall, narrow place, with embossed columns of wood set into the walls that soared up and branched like carved trees to support a glass roof 200 meters above them. The walls of fully two-thirds of the ante-hall were filled up with names. As the two striding captains, in their glossy white plate, drew closer to the strategium end, the wall boards became bare, unoccupied. They passed a group of hooded necrologists, huddled by the last half-filled panel, who were carefully stenciling new names onto the dark wood with gold-dipped brushes. The latest dead, the roll call from the High City battle. The necrologists stopped work and bowed their heads as the two captains went by. Torgadon didn't spare them a second glance, but Logan turned to read the half-writ names. Some of them were brothers from Lacasta he would never see again. "Keep up," Torgadon grunted. High doors, lacquered gold and crimson, stood closed at the end of the avenue hall. Before them, Aximund and Abaddon were waiting. "Garviel," Abaddon smiled. "It doesn't do to keep him waiting," Aximund grumbled. Logan wasn't sure if little Horus meant Abaddon or the commander. "What were you two gabbing about? Like fishwives, the pair of you."
"I was just asking him if he'd settled Vipers in as his proxy," Torgadon said simply.
Aximan glanced at Logan, his wide-set eyes languidly half-hooded by his lids.
"And I was reassuring Tarek that I had," Logan added.
Evidently, Torgadon's quiet heads-up had been for his ears only. "Let's enter," Abaddon said. He raised his gloved hand and pushed the gold and crimson doors wide. A short processional lay before them, a 20-meter colonnade of ebon stone chased with a fretwork of silver wire. It was lined by 40 guardsmen of the Imperial Army, 20 against each wall. They were splendidly appointed in full dress uniforms, long cream greatcoats with gold frogging, high-crowned chrome helms with basket visors and scarlet cockades and matching sashes. The guardsmen came to salute in perfect discipline, and the Mournival stepped past them onto the deck of the strategium, a great semicircular platform that projected like a lip out above the tiered theatre of the flagship's bridge. Far below lay the principal command level, thronging with hundreds of uniformed personnel. To either side, the beehive subdecks of the secondary platforms rose up, past the level of the projecting strategium, up into the roof itself, each story busy with activity. The front section of the bridge chamber was a great, strutted window through which the constellations and the ink of space could be witnessed. The strategium deck itself was an ironwork platform which supported at its centre a circular dais, 1 metre deep, and 10 in diameter. Horus had always eschewed any form of throne or seat. The ironwork walkspace around the dais was half-shadowed by the overhang of tiered galleries that climbed the slopes of the chamber behind it. Several attendant figures stood quietly around the edges of the dais. Lord Commander Hector Varvarus, Marshal of the Expedition's Army, a tall, precise aristocrat in red robes, stood discussing the content of a data slate with two aides. To the master's left, in order, the high senior of the Navis Nobilitae, Navigator Chirurgus, the Master Companion of Vox, the Master Companion of Lucidation, the Master of the Fleet, the Mistress of Astropathy, and various gubernatorial legates. Each one, Logan noticed, had placed a single personal item on the edge of the dais where they stood, a glove, a cap, a wand stave. "The Mournival stays in the shadows," Torgadon told him, bringing Logan up short under the edge of the shade cast by the balcony above. Logan nodded and remained with Torgadon and Aximund in the symbolic shadow of the overhang. Abaddon stepped forward into the light and took his place at the edge of the dais. Abaddon placed his helm upon the edge of the Auslight disc. "An item placed on the dais registers a desire to be heard,"
Togaden told Loken. Ezekiel has a place by dint of his status as first captain. He will speak as first captain, not as the Morneville.
Plated glass doors on the other side of the platform slid open, and a huge figure came out onto the strategium. Everybody dropped in a bow. Loken, going down on one knee, could hear the rustle of others bowing in the balconies above him. Warmaster Horus looked around, smiled, and then leapt up onto the dais in a single bound.
"My friends," he said, "honour's done. Up you get."
Slowly they rose and beheld him. Massive and limber, a demigod manifest, wrapped in white-gold armour and pelts of fur. His head was bare, shaven, sculptural. His face was noble, deeply tanned by multiple sunlights, his wide-spaced eyes bright, his teeth gleaming. He smiled and nodded to each and every one of them. Then he looked at Loken, back in the shadows of the overhang, and his smile seemed to broaden for a second.
"Come, let us begin."
"Rakris," Horus said. His voice was like honey, like steel, like a whisper, like all of those things mixed as one. Lord Governor-elect Rakris, a portly man in dove-grey robes, had already placed his scepter wand on the edge of the dais to mark his participation. Horus heard him out patiently, nodding encouragingly from time to time. Rakris droned on at unnecessary length. Loken felt sorry for him. One of Lord Commander Varvaris's generals, Rakris had been selected to remain at 6319 as governor-overseer, marshalling the occupation forces as the world transmuted into a full imperial state. Rakris was a career soldier, and it was clear that he was quite aghast at the prospect of being left behind. A governorship was intended to be the ultimate reward for a war hero's service, but it seemed to Loken a quietly terrible fate, to be monarch of a world and then cast away upon it, forever. The Crusade would not be back to visit conquered worlds in a hurry.
"In truth, my commander," Rakris was saying, "it may be many decades until this world achieves a state of equity with the Imperium. There is great opposition."
"How far are we from compliance?"
Horus asked, looking around. Varvaris replied, "Decades. There is a seed of dissidence in the southern hemisphere that we cannot quench. Until that is brought into line, this world cannot be certified."
Horus nodded. "So, we stay here until the job is done. We must hold over our plans to advance, unless there is another suggestion."
He looked at Abaddon and let the words hang. Abaddon seemed to hesitate and glanced quickly back into the shadows behind him. Loken realized that this was the question. This was a moment of counsel when the Primarch looked outside the official hierarchy for the informal advice of his chosen inner circle. Togaddon nudged Loken, but the nudge was unnecessary. Loken had already stepped forward into the light behind Abaddon.
"My Lord Warmaster," Loken said, almost startled by the sound of his own voice. "Captain Loken," Horus said with a delighted flash of his eyes, "the thoughts of the Morneville are always welcome."
Several present, including Varvaris, made approving sounds.
"My lord, the initial phase of the war here was undertaken quickly and cleanly," Loken said. "A surgical strike by the spear tip against the enemy's head to minimize the loss and hardship that both sides would suffer in a longer, full-scale offensive. A guerrilla war against insurgents would inevitably be an arduous, drawn-out, costly affair. 6319 cannot afford it, and neither can the expedition. I say that if the spear tip was meant to conquer this world, then it has failed. Order the Legion to finish the job."
Murmuring sprang up all around.
"You should have me unleash the Lunar Wolves again, Captain," Horus asked.
Loken shook his head. "Not as a whole, sir. 10th Company. We were first in, and for that we have been praised. But the praise was not deserved, for the job is not done."
Horus nodded, as if quite taken with this.
"First Captain."
"The Morneville speaks with one voice, Lord," Abaddon said.
"So it shall be," Horus said. smiling broadly again. "Captain, have 10th Company drawn ready an oath to the moment. We will anticipate news of your success eagerly. Thank you for speaking your mind."
There was a flutter of approving applause.
"Then possibilities open for us after all," Horace said. "We can begin to prepare for the next phase. When I signal him, our beloved Emperor will be delighted to learn that our portion of the crusade is about to advance again. We should now discuss the options open to us. I thought to brief you on our findings concerning these myself, but there is another who insists he is fit to do it."
Everyone present turned to look as the glass doors slid open for a second time. The Primarch began to clap, and the applause gathered and swept around the galleries as Malagurst limped out onto the stage of the Strategium. It was the Equerry's first formal appearance since his recovery from the surface. Malagurst was a veteran Lunar Wolf and a son of Horus to boot. He had been in his time a company captain, and might even have risen to the first captaincy had he not been promoted to the office of Equerry. A shrewd and experienced soul, Malagurst's talents for intrigue and intelligence ideally served him in that role, and had long since earned him the title Twisted. He took no shame in this. He had never been well-liked, and had never made any effort to be liked. But circumstance had suddenly made him popular. Believed dead, he had been found alive, and in the light of Sejanus' death, this had been taken as some compensation. Now the assembly welcomed him back rapturously. He had been reinvented through misfortune into an adored hero. Loken was quite sure Malagurst was aware of this ironic turn and fully prepared to make the most of it. Malagurst came out into the open. His injuries had been so severe that he was not yet able to clothe himself in the armour of the Legion, and wore instead a white robe with the wolf's head emblem embroidered on the back. He limped and walked with the aid of a metal staff. His back bulged with a kyphotic misalignment. His face, drawn thin and pale since last it had been seen, was lined with effort, and waddings of synthetic skin gel covered gashes upon his throat and the left side of his head. Loken was shocked to see that he was now truly twisted. The old, mocking nickname suddenly seemed crass and indelicate. Horace got down off the dais and threw his arms around his equerry. Varvarus and Abaddon both went over to greet him with warm embraces. Malagurst smiled and nodded to them, then waved up to the galleries to acknowledge the welcome. As the applause abated, Malagurst leaned heavily against the side of the dais and placed his staff upon it in the ceremonial manner.
"I have enjoyed," Malagurst began, his voice hard but brittle with effort, "a certain luxury of relaxation in these last few days."
Laughter rattled out from all sides, and the clapping resumed for a moment.
"Bed rest," Malagurst went on. "That bane of a warrior's life has suited me well, for it has given me ample opportunity to review the intelligence gathered in these last few months. However, bed rest has its limits. I insisted that I be allowed to present this evidence to you today, for never in my dreams did I imagine I would die of inaction."
More approving laughter. Loken smiled. Malagurst really was making the best use of his new status amongst them.
"To review," Malagurst said, taking out a control wand and gesturing with it briefly. "Three key areas are of interest to us at this juncture."
His gestures activated the underdeck hololithic projectors, and shapes of solid light came into being above the Strategium. The first was a rotating image of the world they orbited, surrounded by graphic indicators of elliptical alignment and precession. The spinning world shrank rapidly until it became part of a system arrangement, similarly draped in schematic overlays. Then that too shrank and became a small component in a mosaic of stars.
"This area here, the cluster adjacent to our current locale,"
a particular stellar neighbourhood on the light map glowed,
our most obvious and accessible next port of call. Scout ships report 18 systems of interest, 12 of which promise fundamental worth in terms of elemental resource, but no signs of life or habitation. The searches are not yet conclusive, but might I be so bold as to suggest that this region need not concern the expedition? Subject to certification, these systems should be added to the manifest of the colonial pioneers who follow in our footsteps.
He waved the wand again, and a different group of stars lit up.
This second region is estimated as 9 weeks standard travel time to Spinwood. We have barely begun to scout this district, but there are early indications that some significant culture or cultures of interstellar capability exist within its bounds. The region has an itemization code, but I believe you'll all be interested to hear that it bears an old Terra name, Sagittarius.
The dreadful Sagittarii, Horus whispered with a delighted grin.
Quite so, my lord. The region certainly requires further examination.
The crippled equerry moved the wand again and brought up a third coil of suns.
Our third option is further to Spinwood, 18 weeks standard. Our scouts have yet to examine it, but we have received word from the 140th expedition commanded by Kittus Frome of the Blood Angels that opposition to Imperial advance has been encountered there. Reports are patchy, but war has broken out.
Human resistance? Varvarus asked.
Xenos, Malagus said succinctly. I have sent a missive to the 140th asking if they require our support. No reply has yet been received. We may consider it a priority to venture forward to this region to reinforce the Imperial presence there.
For the first time since the briefing began, the smile had left the War Master's face. I will speak with my brother Sanguinius on this matter, he said. I would not see his men perish. He looked at Malagurst. Thank you. We appreciate your efforts and the brevity of your summation. There was a ripple of applause. The equerry picked up his staff from the dais and, leaning upon it, turned to the War Master. Horus raised both hands to restore quiet.
Our thanks to Malagurst for presenting these options to us. I dissolve this briefing now, but I request policy suggestions and remarks to my attention in the next day. We will reconvene the day after tomorrow at this time. That is all.
The meeting broke up. As the upper galleries emptied, buzzing with chatter, the parties on the Strategium deck gathered in informal conference. The War Master stood in quiet conversation with Malagurst.
Nicely done,
Torgadon whispered to Loken.
Loken breathed out. He hadn't realized what a weight of tension had built up in him since his summons to the briefing had arrived.
Yes, finally put, said Axemund. I approve your commentary.
Abaddon joined them under the shadow of the overhang. I knew we'd picked right, he said, clasping Loken's hand in his own. Cut to the quick. That's what the War Master wants of us. A clean appraisal. Good job, Garviel.
Enough of your backslapping, Torgadon said. The Mornimal is needed. The War Master is withdrawing, and he has called for us.
The Mornival followed the War Master through the plated glass doors into his private sanctum. Malagurst and the War Master bustled in ahead of them, and the Mornival drew back into the shadows, waiting to be called upon. Loken stiffened as a figure descended the ironwork screw stair into the room from the gallery above. Another god. Rogel Dorn, Primarch of the Imperial Fists, brother to Horus. Dorn greeted the War Master warmly before Horus went to sit with Malagurst upon the black leather couches facing the glass wall. Rogel Dorn was a being as great in all measure as Horus. He had been travelling with the expedition for some months, though he was expected to take his leave soon. Other duties and expeditions called. Loken had been told that Primarch Dorn had come to them at Horus's behest, so that the two of them might discuss the obligations and remit of the role of War Master. Horus had solicited the opinions and advice of all his brother primarchs on the subject since the honour had been bestowed upon him. Being named War Master set him abruptly apart from them, and raised him up above his brothers, and there had been some stifled objections and discontent, especially from those primarchs who felt the title should have been theirs. Horus had courted his brothers, stilling fears, calming doubts, reaffirming pacts, and securing their cooperation. Some, like Sanguinius, Lorgar, and Fulgrim, had acclaimed Horus's election from the outset. Others, like Angron and Pertirabo, had raged biliously at the new order, and it had taken masterful diplomacy on the War Master's part to placate their choler and jealousy. A few, like Russ and the Lion, had been cynically resolved, unsurprised by the turn of events. But others, like Gulliman, Khan, and Dorn, had simply taken it in their stride, accepting the Emperor's decree as the right and obvious choice. Horus had ever been the brightest, the first, and the favourite. They did not doubt his fitness for the role, for none of the Primarchs had ever matched Horus's achievements, nor the intimacy of his bond with the Emperor. It was to these solid, resolved brothers that Horus turned in particular for counsel. Dorn and Gulliman both embodied the staunchest and most dedicated Imperial qualities, commanding their legion expeditions with peerless devotion and military genius. Horus desired their approval, as a young man might seek the quiescence of older, more accomplished brothers. Rogel Dorn possessed perhaps the finest military mind of all the Primarchs. Dorn's record in the Crusade was second only to Horus's, but he was resolute where Horus was flamboyant, reserved where Horus was charismatic, and that was why Horus had been the obvious choice for War Master. In keeping with his patient, stony character, Dorn's legion had become renowned for siegecraft and defensive strategies. The War Master had once joked that where he could storm a fortress like no other, Rogel Dorn could hold it.
"If ever I laid assault to a bastion possessed by you," Horus had quipped at a recent banquet, "then the war would last for all eternity, the best in attack matched by the best in defence."
The Imperial fists were an immovable object to the Lunar Wolves' unstoppable force. Primarch Dorn wore a case of armour that was burnished and ornate like a tomb chest, dark red and copper gold compared to Horus's white dazzle. Unfurled eagle wings fashioned in metal haloed his head and decorated his chest and shoulder plate, and aquilas and graven laurels embossed the armour sections of his limbs. A mantle of red velvet hung around his broad shoulders, trimmed in golden weave. His lean face was stern and unsmiling even when the War Master raised a joke, and his hair was a shock of white, bleached like dead bones.
"Lokan," he said, gesturing. "Come, I would like very much to speak with the newest member of the Morneval."
Lokan followed the massive Primarch to the far corner of the chamber. Behind them, the other three Mornevals shared war stories, and elsewhere Horus sat in intense conference with Malagust.
"I shall miss the 63rd Expeditionary Fleet once I take its leave," Dorn said conversationally. His voice was low and astonishingly soft, but there was a strength running through it. "We are charged to return to the homeworld. The Emperor has asked us to fortify the Imperial stronghold, and who am I to question the Emperor's needs?"
Dorn looked down at Lokan.
"You're not used to the likes of me, are you, Lokan?"
"No, Lord."
"I like that about you. Ezekiel and Tarek, men like them, have been so long in the company of your Lord they think nothing of it. You, however, understand that a Primarch is not like a man, or even an Astartes. I'm not talking about strength. I'm talking about weight of responsibility."
"Yes, Lord."
Dorn sighed.
"The Emperor has no like, Lokan. There are no gods in this hollow universe to keep him company. So he made us, demigods, to stand beside him. I have never quite come to terms with my status. I see what I am capable of and what is expected of me, and I shudder. Do you think your Lord Horus ever feels that way?
I do not, Lord, Loken said. Self-confidence is one of his keenest qualities.
I think so, too, and I am glad of it. There could be no better war master than Horus, but a man, even a Primarch, is only as good as the counsel he receives. He must be tempered and guided by those close to him.
You speak of the Morneville, sir.
Rogel Dorn nodded.
You know that I spoke in support of your election.
I have been told so, Lord. It flatters me.
Horus needs an honest voice in his ear, a voice that appreciates the scale and import of our undertaking, a voice that is not blasé in the company of demigods. The Morneville needs a proper, dissenting opinion.
A Naismith, Loken said.
Dorn flashed a real smile.
Yes, just so, like the old Dynast did. A Naismith. Your schooling's good. Horus needs a voice of reason in his ear, if he is to reign in his eagerness and act in the Emperor's stead. Our other brothers, some of them quite demented by the choice of Horus, need to see he is firmly in control. So I vouched for you, Garviel Loken. I examined your record and your character and thought you would be the right mix in the alloy of the Morneville.
Don't be insulted, but there is something very human about you, for an Astartes.
You spoke of responsibility. I feel that weight suddenly.
Dorn turned from the armoured port and looked down at Loken. He placed his great hands gently on Loken's shoulders.
Just be yourself. Speak your mind plainly, for you have been granted the rare opportunity to do so. I can leave confident that the Crusade is in safe hands.
I wonder if your faith in me is too much, Lord, Loken said.
I have just proposed a war.
That is all part of your role now. Sometimes you must advise, sometimes you must allow the War Master to use you.
Use me?
You understand what Horus had you do this morning.
Lord?
He had primed the Morneville to back him, Loken. He is cultivating the air of a peacemaker, for that plays well across the worlds of the Imperium. This morning, he wanted someone other than himself to suggest unleashing the legions for war.
Bracing himself against the low overhead handrails, Loken moved down the spinal aisle of the lead Stormbird. Lunar Wolves, impassive behind their visors, sat in the rear-facing cage seats either side of him. The bird shuddered as it cut its path through the upper atmosphere. He reached the cockpit section and wrenched open the hatch to enter. Two flight officers sat back to back, facing wall panel consoles, and beyond them two pilot servitors lay, hard-wired into forward-facing helm positions in the cone.
Captain, one of the flight officers said, looking up.
What's the problem with the Vox? Loken asked. I've had several reports of comm faults from the men, ghosting and chatter.
We're getting that too, sir, the officer said, his hands playing over his controls.
Seems to be getting worse, Loken said.
He adjusted his helm and tried his link again. The static hiss was still there, but now it had shapes in it, like muffled words.
Is that language? He asked.
The officer shook his head. Can't tell, sir. It's just reading as general interference.
We need clean vox, Loken said.
The officer shrugged and adjusted several dials.
I can wash it through the signal buffers. Maybe that will tidy up the channels.
In Loken's ears, there was a sudden rush of static, and then things became quieter suddenly.
Better, he said.
Then he paused. Now the hiss was gone. He could hear the voice. It was tiny, but it was speaking proper words.
What is that? Loken asked.
He strained to hear. The voice was so very far away, like a rustle of silk. The flight officer craned his neck, listening to his own headphones. He made minute adjustments to the dials.
I might be able to,
he began, a touch of his hand that suddenly cleaned the signal to audibility.
What in the Emperor's name is that? He asked.
Loken listened. The voice, like a gust of dry desert wind, said,
Samus. That's the only name you'll hear. Samus. It means the end and the death. Samus. I am Samus. Samus is all around you. Samus will gnaw upon your bones. Look out! Samus is here.
The voice faded. The channel went dead and quiet, except for the occasional echo pop. The flight officer took off his headset and looked at Loken. His face was wide-eyed and fearful. Loken recoiled slightly. He wasn't made to deal with fear. The concept disgusted him.
I don't know what that was, the flight officer said. I do, said Loken. Our enemy is trying to scare us.
Following the Emperor's death and the fall of their ancient centralized government, the insurgents had fled into the mounting massifs of the southern hemisphere and occupied a fastness in a range of peaks called the Whisperheads. Dawn was coming up, and the mountings loomed as stern, misty steeples of pale green ice that reflected sun glare. The stormbirds dropped from the edge of space, trailing golden fire from their ablative surfaces. In the frugal habitations and villages in the foothills, the townsfolk, born into a culture of myth and superstition, saw the fiery marks in the dawn sky as an omen. Many fell to wailing and lamenting, or hurried to their village fanes. The religious faith of 6319, strong in the capital and the major cities, was distilled here into a more potent brew. These were impoverished backwaters, where the anachronistic beliefs of the society were heightened by a subsistence lifestyle and poor education. The Imperial Army had already struggled to contain this primitive zealotry during its occupation. The Stormbirds sat down, engines screaming, on a plateau of dry, white lava rock 5,000 meters below the caps of the highest peaks where the rebel fastness lay. 10th Company clattered out into the sparse, chilly air, weapons ready. They came to martial order and disembarked as smoothly as Loken could have wished. But the Vox was still disturbed. Every few minutes,
Samus
chattered again, like a sigh upon the mountain wind. Loken called the senior squad leaders to him as soon as he had landed. Vipus of Locasta, Jubal of Hellbore, Rasik of the Terminator Squad, Talonus of Pithres, Kyrus of Warcure, and eight more. All grouped around, showing deference to Xavier Jubal. Loken, who had always read men well as a commander, needed none of his honed leadership skills to realize that Jubal wasn't wearing Vipus's elevation well. Loken had followed his gut and appointed Nero Vipus his proxy commander to serve when matters of state drew Loken apart from 10th. Vipus was popular, but Jubal, a sergeant of the first squad, felt slighted. There was no rule that stated the sergeant of a company's first squad automatically followed in seniority. The sequencing was simply a numerical distinction, but there was a given order to things, and Jubal felt aggrieved. He had told Loken so several times.
"Let's do this, and quickly," Loken told his officers. "The Terminators have the lead here. Rasik?"
"My squad is ready to serve, Captain," Rasik replied curtly. Like all the men in his specialist squad, Sergeant Rasik wore the titanic armour of a Terminator, a variant only lately introduced into the arsenal of the Astartes. By dint of their primacy and the fact that their Primarch was Warmaster, the Lunar Wolves had been amongst the first legion to benefit from the issue of Terminator plate. Thickly plated, a Terminator suit turned an Astartes warrior into a slow, cumbersome, but entirely unstoppable humanoid tank. An Astartes clad in Terminator plate gave up all his speed, dexterity, agility, and range of movement. What he got in return was the ability to shrug off almost any ballistic attack. Rasik towered over them in his armour, dwarfing them as a Primarch dwarfs Astartes, or an Astartes dwarfs mortal men. Massive weapon systems were built into his shoulders, arms, and gauntlets.
"Lead off to the bridges and clear the way," Loken said.
He paused. Now was a moment for gentle diplomacy.
"Jubal, I want Hellbore to follow the Terminators in as the weight of the first strike."
Jubal nodded. evidently pleased. The scowl of displeasure he had been wearing for weeks now lifted for a moment. Loken saw Nero Viper smile, and knew he understood the significance of this instruction. Loken was offering Jubal some measure of glory to reassure him he was not forgotten.
"Let's go to it!" Loken cried. "Lupercal! Lupercal!"
the officers answered. They clamped their helms into place. Portions of the company began to move ahead towards the natural rock bridges and causeways that linked the plateau to the higher terrain. Army regiments swaddled in heavy coats and rebreathers against the cold, thin air had moved up onto the plateau to meet them from the town of Kesseri in the lower gorge.
"Kesseri is at compliance, sir," an officer told Loken, his voice muffled by his mask, his breathing pained and ragged. "The enemy has withdrawn to the high fortress."
"We'll take it from here," Loken said.
He turned.
"Jubal, Vipers, form up and move ahead."
"Just like that?"
the army officer asked sourly.
6 weeks we've been here, slogging it out. The body toll like you wouldn't believe, and you..."
"We're Astartes," Loken said. "You're relieved."
The officer shook his head with a sad laugh. He muttered something under his breath. Loken turned back and took a step towards the man, causing him to start in alarm.
"What did you say?" Loken asked.
"I said, and the place is haunted, sir."
"If you believe this place is haunted, my friend," Loken said, "then you are admitting to a belief in spirits and demons."
"All I mean," said the soldier breathlessly, his face flushed and sweaty behind his breather mask, "is that there's something about this place, these mountains, they're called the Whisperheads, and I've spoken to some of the locals in Kathery. The locals believe that a man might hear voices out here when there's no one around.
Superstition. Bringing light to that ignorance is part of why we're here."
"So what are the voices, sir?"
"What?"
"Since we've been here, fighting our way up the valley, we've all heard them. I've heard them. Whispers in the night, and sometimes in the bold brightness of day when there's no one about. And on the Vox, too. Samus has been talking."
Loken stared at the man.
"Who is Samus?"
"Damned if I know," the officer shrugged.
"They're just trying to scare us," Loken said.
"Well, it worked then, didn't it?"
Beyond the rock bridges, the insurgents had raised shield walls of stone and metal. They had heavy cannons covering the gully approaches to their fortress, wired munition charges in the narrow defiles, electrified razor wire, bolted storm doors, barricades of rockcrete blocks and heavy iron poles. They had a few automated sentry devices and the advantage of the sheer drop and unscalable ice all around. They had faith and their god on their side. They had held off Varvarus's regiments for 6 weeks. They had no chance whatsoever. Shrugging off cannon rounds and the backwash of explosives, the Terminators wrenched their way through the shield walls and blasted down the storm doors. They crushed the spark of electric life out of the sentry drones and pushed down the heaped barricades. The company flooded in behind them, firing their weapons into the rising smoke. The fortress itself had been built into the mountain peak. Some sections of roof and battlement were visible from outside, but most of the structure lay within, thickly armoured by hundreds of metres of rock. The Lunar Wolves poured in through the fortified gates. Assault squads rose up the mountain face on their jump packs and settled like flocks of white birds on the exposed roofs, ripping them apart to gain entry and drop in from above. The interior was a maze of wet black rock tunnels and old tilework, through which the wind funneled so sharply it seemed to be hyperventilating. The bodies of the slain lay everywhere, slumped and twisted, sprawled and broken. Stepping over them, Loken pitied them. Their culture had deceived them into this resistance, and the resistance had brought down the wrath of the Astartes on their heads. They had all but invited a catastrophic doom. Terrible human screams echoed down the windy rock tunnels, punctuated by bolter fire. Loken hadn't even bothered to keep a tally of his kills. There was little glory in this, just duty. Gunfire pinged off his armour, and he turned and cut down his assailants. Two men in mail shirts disintegrated under his fire and spattered across a wall. He couldn't understand why they were still fighting. If they'd ventured a surrender, he would have accepted it.
"That way," he ordered,
and a squad moved up past him into the next series of chambers. As he followed them, a body on the floor at his feet stirred and moaned. The insurgent, gravely wounded, looked up at Loken with glassy eyes. He whispered something. Loken knelt down and cradled his enemy's head in one massive hand.
"What did you say?"
"Bless me. Say a prayer and commend me to the gods."
"I can't. There are no gods. You're dying. That's all there is."
"Help me!"
the man gasped.
"Of course," Loken said.
He drew his combat blade and activated the power cell. The grey blade glowed with force. Loken cut down and sharply back up again in a mercy stroke and gently set the man's detached head to the ground. The next chamber was vast and irregular. Meltwater trickled down from the black ceiling and formed spurs of glistening mineral like silver whiskers on the rocks it ran over. A pool had been cut in the centre of the chamber floor to collect the meltwater, probably as one of the fortress's primary water reserves. The squad he had sent on had come to a halt around its lip.
"Report," he said.
One of the wolves looked round.
"What is this, Captain?" he asked.
Loken stepped forward to join them and saw that a great number of bottles and glass flasks had been set around the pool. At first, he assumed they were to collect the water, but there were other items too, coins, brooches, strange doll-like figures of clay, and the bones of small animals. On the overhang of rock above the pool, ancient script had been chiselled. Loken couldn't read the words and realized he didn't want to. There were symbols there that made him feel curiously uneasy.
"It's a feign," he said simply. "You know what these locals are like. They believe in spirits, and these are offerings."
The men glanced at one another, not really understanding.
"They believe in things that aren't real?" asked one.
"They've been deceived," Loken said. "That's why we're here. Destroy this," he instructed, and turned away.
The assault lasted 68 minutes, start to finish. By the end, the fastness was a smoking ruin, many sections of it blown wide to the fierce sunlight and mountain air. Not a single lunar wolf had been lost. Not a single insurgent had survived. In the course of the assault, something in the region of 30 meltwater fanes had been discovered in the labyrinthine fortress, pools surrounded by offerings. Loken ordered them all expunged. "They were guarding the last outpost of their faith," Nero Vipus remarked.
"I suppose so," Loken replied.
"You don't like it, do you, Garvey?" Vipus asked.
"This is what we were once. Believers in lies we made up ourselves. The Emperor showed us the path out of that madness."
"So, be of good humour that we've taken it," Vipus said.
Loken nodded. "I feel sorry for them," he said. "They must be so scared."
"Of us?"
"Yes, of course. But that's not what I mean. Scared of the truth we bring. They felt safe until we came. Safe in the custody of the spirits that they believed watched over them. Safe in the ideal that there was an afterlife, an other world. They thought they would be immortal beyond flesh."
"Now they have met real immortals," Vipers quipped. "It's a hard lesson, but they'll be better for it in the long run."
Loken shrugged. "I empathize. Their lives were comforted by mysteries, and we've taken that comfort away. All we can show them is an unforgiving reality in which their lives are brief and without higher purpose."
"Speaking of higher purpose," Vipers said, "you should signal the fleet and tell them we're done. The iterators have voxed us. They request permission to bring the observers up to the site here."
"Granted. I'll signal the fleet and give them the good news."
Vipers turned away, then halted.
"At least that voice shut up," he said.
Loken nodded. Samus had quit his ramblings half an hour since, though the assault had failed to identify any vox system or broadcast device. Loken's intervox crackled.
"Captain?"
"Jubal, go ahead.
I found something. Samus. It means the end and the death."
"What have you found, Jubal?"
"Samus. Samus is here."
Loken left Vipers to orchestrate the cleanup and descended into the bowels of the fastness with 7th Squad, following the pip of Jubal's locator. 7th Squad, Breakspur Tactical Squad, was commanded by Sergeant Udon, one of Loken's most reliable warriors. The locator led them down to a massive stone well in the very basement of the fortress. deep in the heart of the mountain. They gained access to it via a corroded iron gate built into a niche in the dark stone. The dank chamber beyond the gate was a natural vertical split in the mountain rock, a slanting cavern that overlooked a deep fault where only blackness could be detected. A pier of old stone steps arced out over the abyss, which dropped away into the very bottom of the mountain. Meltwater sprinkled down the walls of the cavern well. Xavier Jubal was alone at the edge of the drop. As Loken and Seventh Squad approached, Loken wondered where the rest of Hellbore had gone.
"Xavier!" Loken called.
Jubal looked around. "Captain," he said, "I found something wonderful."
"What?"
"There."
"I see only water," Loken said. "Falling water."
"Yes, yes. It's written in the water, in the falling water. It makes words, and they stream away, but the words come back."
"Xavier, are you well?
Look, Gavia, look at the words. Can't you hear the water speaking one name? Samus. That's the only name you'll hear."
"Samus?"
"Samus. It means the end and the death. I'm..."
Loken looked at Udon. "Restrain him," he said quietly.
Udon nodded. He and four of his men slung their bolters and stepped forward. Jubal laughed. "Are you threatening me? Gavriel, can't you see? Samus is all around you."
"Where's Hellbore, Jubal?" Loken snapped. "Where's the rest of your squad?"
Jubal shrugged. "They didn't see it either," he said, and glanced towards the edge of the precipice. "It's so clear to me. Samus is the man beside you."
"Udon," Loken nodded. Udon moved towards Jubal. "Let's go, brother," he said kindly.
Jubal's bolter came up without warning. He shot Udon in the face, blowing gore and pulverized skull fragments out through the back of Udon's exploded helm. Udon fell on his face. Two of his men lunged forward, and the bolter roared again, punching holes in their chest plates and throwing them over onto their backs. Jubal's visor swung to look at Loken. "I'm Samus," he said, chuckling. "Look out! Samus is here!"
Sergeant Udon, his helm a deformed ring of bloody ceramite, lay dead at Loken's feet. Beside him sprawled two other battle brothers, shot point-blank through the hearts, if not dead, then fatally damaged. Before him stood Jubal, bolter in hand. This was madness. This could not be. Astartes had turned upon Astartes. A lunar wolf had murdered his own kind. The insanity of this crime would echo forever. "Jubal, what have you done?"
"Not Jubal. Samus. I am Samus."
Jubal's voice had a catch in it, a dry giggle. Loken knew he was about to fire again. The rest of Udon's squad, quite as aghast as Loken, stumbled forward, but none raised their bolters. Even in the stark light of what Jubal had just done, not one of them could break the sworn code of the Astartes and fire upon one of their own. Loken knew he certainly couldn't. He threw his bolter aside and leapt at Jubal, throwing a punch that would have decapitated a mortal man. His fist cracked against Jubal's helm, and he repeated the action, driving his fist four or five times against the other's face and chest. The ceramite visor chipped, another punch, his full weight behind it, and Jubal stumbled. Each stroke of Loken's fist resounded like a smith's hammer in the echoing chamber. As Jubal stumbled, Loken grabbed his bolter and tore it out of his hand. He hurled it away across the deep stone well. But Jubal was not yet done. He seized Loken and thrust him sideways into the rock wall. Lumps of stone flew out of the jarring impact. Jubal slammed him again, hurling Loken bodily into the rock like a man swinging a heavy sack. Pain flared through Loken's head, and he tasted blood in his mouth. He tried to pull away, but Jubal was throwing punches that ploughed into Loken's visor and bounced the back of his head off the wall repeatedly. The other men were upon them, shouting and grappling to separate them. "Hold him down!" Loken yelled. They were Astartes, as strong as young gods in their power armor, but they could not do as Loken ordered. Jubal lashed out with a free fist and knocked one of them clean off his feet. Two of the remaining three clung to his back like wrestlers, trying to pull him down, but he hoisted them up and twisted, throwing them off him. Jubal turned on the remaining brother, who launched himself forward to tackle the madman.
"Samus is here!"
Jubal screamed with a cackle.
His lancing right hand met the brother head-on. Jubal struck with an open hand, fingers extended, and those fingers drove clean in through the battle brother's gorget as surely as any spear-tip. Blood squirted out from the man's throat through the puncture in the armour. Jubal ripped his hand out, and the brother fell to his knees, choking and gurgling. Beyond any thought of reason now, Loken hurled himself at Jubal, but the berserker turned and smacked him away with a mighty backhand slap. The power of the blow was stupendous, far beyond anything even an Astartes should have been able to wield. The force was so great that the armour of Jubal's gauntlet fractured, as did the plating of Loken's shoulder, which took the brunt. Loken blacked out for a split second, then was aware that he was sailing across the stone well and out over the abyssal fault. Loken struck the arching pier of stone steps. He almost bounced off it, but he managed to grab on, his feet swinging above the drop. Melt water poured down in a thin rain across him, making the steps slick and oily. Loken's fingers began to slide. Fury pulled him up. Fury and an intense passion that he would not fail the War Master, not in the face of this terrible wrong. He hauled himself upright onto the pier. His limbs were shaking with effort. He saw Jubal charging forward across the cavern to the foot of the steps, drawing his combat blade. Loken wrenched out his own sword. Falling meltwater hissed and sparked as it touched the active metal of the short, stabbing blade. Loken prided himself on maintaining a masterful discipline and practice of all weapons. He regularly clocked 6 or 8 hours at a time in the flagship's practice cages. He expected all of the men in his command to do likewise. Xavier Jubal was foremost a master with daggers, but no slouch with a sword. Except today, Jubal had forgotten all his skill in the flush of madness that had engulfed his mind. He attacked Loken like a maniac, in a frenzy of savage cuts and blows. 3 times Loken managed to drive Jubal back down the pier, but always the other man retaliated and forced Loken higher up the arch. The steps were treacherous, and it was as much a fight to keep balance as to resist Jubal's constant assault. It ended suddenly, like a jolt. Jubal passed Loken's guard and sunk the full edge of his blade into Loken's left shoulder plate. "Samus is here!" he cried in delight. But his blade, flaring with power, was wedged fast.
"Samus is done," Loken replied,
and drove the tip of his sword into Jubal's exposed chest. Jubal wavered, letting go of his own weapon, which remained transfixed through Loken's shoulder guard. With half-open, shuddering hands, he reached at Loken's face as if imploring some mercy or even aid.
"Samus!"
he gasped. Loken wrenched his sword out. Jubal toppled backwards, crashing over and over down the steps in a windmill of heavy, loose limbs. 5 meters from the base of the pier, his headlong career bounced him half off the steps, and he came to a halt, partly hanging over the chasm, gradually sliding backwards under his own weight. Loken heard the slow squeal of armour scraping against slick stone. He leapt down the flight to reach Jubal's side. He got there just moments before Jubal slid away. Loken grabbed Jubal by the edge of his left shoulder plate and slowly began to heave him back onto the pier. The 3 surviving members of Breakspear Squad stood at the foot of the steps, watching him struggle. "Help me!" Loken yelled. "Why?" one asked. "Why would you want to save him?" "Help me!" Loken snarled again. They didn't move. In desperation, Loken raised his sword and stabbed it down, spearing Jubal's right shoulder to the steps. Loken hauled his body back onto the pier. "Find Vipus," he ordered. "Find him now, and tell him to bring Cinderman to me." Vipus led Cinderman up into the ruined fastness. The wind moaned and whistled through the grim tunnels and chambers. Army troopers were clearing the dead from the entry halls, but still Vipus had to steer the iterator past many corpses. He kept saying such things as, "I'm sorry I had to see that, sir," and "look away to spare your sensibilities." Cinderman could not look away. He had iterated loyally for many years, but this was the first time he had walked across a fresh battlefield. The sights appalled him and burned themselves into his memory. This was what Astartes did. This was the reality of the Emperor's crusade. Mortal hurt on a scale that passed belief. By the time he was brought to Loken, who awaited him in one of the fortress's upper chambers, he truly believed that he would never again witness horror such as this as long as he lived. Loken was standing in a wide, dark chamber beside some sort of pool. A dozen solemn lunar wolves attended Loken, including one giant fellow in glowering Terminator armor. But Loken himself was bareheaded, his face smudged with bruises. He'd removed his left shoulder guard, which lay beside him on the ground, stuck through with a short sword.
"I don't think I quite understood what you Astartes were capable of, but now I..."
Cinderman said, his voice small. He looked at the lunar wolves around him and dismissed them with a nod. They filed out past Cinderman, ignoring him.
"Stay close, Nero,"
Loken called. Stepping out through the chamber door, Vipers nodded. Now the room was almost empty. Cinderman could see that a body lay beside the pool. It was the body of a lunar wolf, limp and dead. His arms had been lashed to his trunk with climbing cable.
"I don't understand, Captain. I was told there had been no losses,"
Cinderman began.
Loken nodded slowly. "That's what we're going to say. The 10th took this fortress in a clean strike, with no losses, and that's true enough."
"But this man?"
Loken looked at Cinderman. His face was troubled, more troubled than the iterator had ever seen before.
"What is it, Garviel?"
he asked.
"I need your counsel now."
Cinderman stepped forward and placed his hand on the giant warrior's arm.
"You may trust me with any matter. I'm here to serve."
"There have been deaths today. 6 brothers of Breakspear Squad, another barely clinging to life, and Hellbore has vanished, and I fear they are dead too."
"This can't be. The insurgents couldn't have..."
"They did nothing. This is Xavier Jubal," Loken said, pointing towards the body. "He killed the men."
Cinderman rocked back as if slapped. He blinked.
"He what? I'm sorry. I thought..."
"He killed the men. Jubal killed the men. He killed 6 of Breakspear right in front of my eyes, and he would have killed me too if I hadn't run him through."
Cinderman felt his legs tremble. He found a nearby rock and sat down abruptly.
"What?"
he gasped.
"Astartes do not fight Astartes. It is counter to the very gene code the Emperor fused into us when he wrought us."
"There must be some mistake," Cinderman said.
"No mistake. I saw him do it. He was possessed."
"What? You look to old terms, Garviel. Possession is a spiritualist word that..."
"He was possessed. He claimed he was Samus."
"Oh."
Loken touched the bruises on his face, feeling the ache of them.
"Iterator, are spirits real?"
"Absolutely not."
"So we are taught, but could they exist?"
"No,"
Cinderman replied more firmly.
"There are no spirits. Truth has shown us this. We have learned much during our time amongst the stars, and the most pertinent of those things is that there is always a rational explanation."
"And Astartes draws his weapon and kills his own. Rationalize that, sir."
Cinderman rose.
"Calm yourself, Garviel, and I will."
Loken didn't reply. Cinderman walked over to Jubal's body and stared at it. Jubal's open, staring eyes were rolled back in his skull and utterly bloodshot. The flesh of his face was drawn and shriveled, as if he had aged 10,000 years. Strange patterns, like clusters of blemishes or moles, were visible on the painfully stretched skin.
"These marks," said Cinderman, "could they be the traces of disease or infection?"
"Astartes are resistant," Loken said.
"To most things, but not to everything. I think this could be something so virulent that it destroyed Jubal's mind along with his body. Plagues can drive men insane and corrupt their flesh."
"But he behaved as if possessed," Loken said, repeating the word with brutal emphasis.
"We've all been exposed to the enemy's propaganda. If Jubal's mind was deranged by fever, he might simply have been repeating the words he'd heard."
Loken thought for a moment.
"A plague," Loken nodded. "It's a sound explanation."
"You've suffered a tragedy today, Garviel, but spirits and demons played no part in it. Get to work. You need to lock down this area in quarantine and get a Medicaid task force here."
Cinderman looked back down at the body.
He has been so ravaged. I weep to see this waste.
With a creak of dried sinew, Jubal raised his head and stared up at Cinderman with blood-red eyes.
"Look out!" he wheezed. Jubal rose. The ropes binding him sheared and split, releasing his arms. He screamed and then screamed again. His frantic wail soared and echoed around the chamber. Cinderman stumbled backwards in total panic. Loken ran forward and tried to restrain the reanimating madman. Jubal struck out with one flashing fist and caught Loken in the chest. Loken flew backwards into the pool with a crash of water. Jubal turned, hunched. Saliva dangled from his slack mouth, and his bloodshot eyes spun like compasses at true north.
"Please, oh, please," Cinderman gabbled, backing away.
"Look out!" The words crawled sluggishly out of Jubal's drooling mouth. He lumbered forward. Something was happening to him, something malign and catastrophic. He was bulging, expanding so furiously that his armor began to crack and shatter. Sections of broken plate split and fell away from him, exposing thick arms swollen with gangrene and fibrous growths. His taut flesh was pallid and blue, his face was distorted, puffy and livid, and his tongue flopped out of his rotting mouth. He raised his meaty, distended hands triumphantly, exposing fingernails grown into dark hooks and claws.
"Samus is here," he drawled.
"You killed it?"
"Yes," said Loken, gazing at the dirt floor, his mind somewhere else.
"You're sure?"
Loken looked up out of his reverie.
"What?"
"I need to be sure," Abaddon said. "You killed it."
"Yes."
Loken was sitting on a crude hardwood stool in one of the long houses in Kasseri. Night had fallen outside, bringing with it a keening, malevolent wind that shrieked around the gorge and the Whisperhead peaks. A dozen oil lamps lit the place with a feeble ochre glow.
"We killed it. Nero and I together, with our bolters. It took 90 rounds at full auto. It burst and burned, and we used a flamer to cremate all that remained."
Abaddon nodded. "How many people know?"
"About that last actor, myself, Nero, and Cinderman. Everyone else who saw it is dead."
"What have you said?"
"Nothing, Ezekiel."
Abaddon scooped up another stool and brought it over to sit down facing Loken. Both were in full plate, their helms removed. Abaddon hunched his head low to catch Loken's eyes.
"I'm proud of you, Gaviel. You hear me? You dealt with this well."
"What did I deal with?" Loken asked somberly.
"The situation. Tell me, before Jubal rose again, who knew of the murders?"
"More. Those of Breakspur that survived, all of my officers. I wanted their advice."
"I'll speak to them," Abaddon muttered. "This mustn't get out. Our line will be as you set it. Victory, splendid, but unexceptional. The 10th crushed the insurgents, though losses were taken in 2 squads. But that is war. We expect casualties. The insurgents fought bitterly and formidably to the last. Hellbore and Breakspur bore the brunt of their rage, but 6319 has advanced to full compliance. Glory to the 10th and the Lunar Wolves. Glory the Warmaster. The rest will remain a matter of confidence within the inner circle. Can Cinderman be trusted to keep this close?"
"Of course, though he is very shaken."
The longhouse door banged open, and the gale squealed in for a moment before the door closed again. Loken didn't look up. He was expecting Vipers back at any time with the muster reports.
"Leave us, Ezekiel," a voice said.
It wasn't Vipers. Horus was not wearing his armour. He was dressed in simple foul weather clothes, a mail shirt and a cloak of furs. Abaddon bowed his head and quickly left the longhouse. Loken had risen to his feet.
"Sit, Gaviel," Horus said softly. "Make no ceremony to me."
Loken slowly sat back down, and the War Master knelt beside him. He plucked off his black leather gloves and placed his bare left hand on Loken's shoulder.
"I want you to let go of your troubles, my son," he said.
"I've made a failure of this undertaking, sir," Loken said.
"Ezekiel says we will put a brave face on it for appearance's sake, but I will bear the shame of failing you." "And how did you do that?"
"Men died. A brother turned upon his own. Such a manifest sin. You charged me to take this seat of resistance, and I have made such a mess of it that you have been forced to come here in person to... Did you crush the insurgents of 6319? Well, yes, and did you lead your men into the zone of war and conduct them to glory, no matter the ferocity of the foe? Yes, then I can't see how you failed in any way. When Jabal turned, did you give up? Did you cast away your courage? Or did you fight against his insanity and his crime, despite your wonder at it? I fought, sir, Loken said. Yes, you did. Loken, you fought. Cast shame out. I will not have it. You served me well today, and I am only sorry that the extent of your service cannot be more widely proclaimed. Loken started to reply, but fell silent instead. Horus rose to his feet and began to pace about the room. He found a bottle of wine amongst the clutter on a wall dresser and poured himself a glass.
I spoke to Cinderman, he said,
and took a sip of the wine. He nodded to himself before continuing, as if surprised at its quality.
Poor Kirill. Such a terrible thing to endure. He's even speaking of spirits, you know. Cinderman, the arch-prophet of secular truth, speaking of spirits. I put him right, naturally. He mentioned spirits were a concern of yours, too. Kirill convinced me it was a plague, but I saw a demon take hold of Jubal's soul and turn him against his own kind. No, you didn't, Horus said. Sir? Horus smiled. I'll tell you what you saw. It's a secret thing known to very few, though the Emperor knows more than any of us. Can you keep it?
I will, Loken said. The War Master took another sip.
It was the warp, Gaviel.
The warp?
Of course it was. We know the power of the warp and the chaos it contains. We've seen it change men. We've seen the wretched things that infest its dark dimensions. I know you have. On Eridus, on Syrinx, on the bloody coast of Tassilon, there are entities in the warp that we might easily mistake for demons.
Sir, Loken began. I have been trained in the study of the warp. I have fought the foul things that pour forth from the gates of the Empyrean. And yes, the warp can seep into a man and transmute him.
Do you understand the full mechanism of the warp, Gaviel? Horus asked.
He raised a glass to the nearest light to examine the color of the wine.
No, sir. I don't pretend to. Neither do I. Neither does the Emperor. It pains me to admit that. But it is the truth. The warp is a vital tool to us, a means of communication and transport. Without it, there would be no Imperium of Man, for there would be no quick bridges between the stars. It is a wild thing that tolerates our presence, but brooks no mastery. There is power in the warp, fundamental power, elemental and anathema to us. It is a tool we use at our own risk.
Loken rose to his feet. He looked around the lamp-lit room and heard the moaning of the mounting wind outside.
I have seen psychers taken by the warp, sir, he said, but I have never seen an Astartes so abused.
It happens, Horus replied.
He grinned.
Does that shock you? I'm sorry. We keep it quiet. The warp can get into anything if it so pleases. Today was a particular triumph for its ways. These mountains are not haunted, but the warp is close to the surface here. That fact alone has given rise to the myths. Men have always found techniques to control the warp, and the folk here have done precisely that. They let the warp loose upon you today, and brave Jubal paid the price.
Why him?
Why not him? He was angry at you for overlooking him, and his anger made him vulnerable. The tendrils of the warp are always eager to exploit such chinks in the mind. I imagine the insurgents hoped that scores of your men would fall under the power they had let loose, but Tenth Company had more resolve than that. Samus was just a voice from the chaotic realm that briefly anchored itself to Jubal's flesh. You dealt with it well. It could have been far worse.
Why have we been told so little about the warp? Loken asked. He looked directly into Horus's wide-set eyes as he asked the question.
Because so little is known, the War Master replied. Do you know why I'm War Master?
Because you are the most worthy, sir. Horus laughed and shook his head.
I am War Master because the Emperor is busy.
After Ulanor, he believed the time had come when he could leave the crusading work in the hands of the Primarchs, so that he might be freed to undertake a still higher calling. "Which is?" Logan waited for an answer, expecting some transcendent truth. What the War Master said was, "I don't know. He hasn't told anyone." Horus paused for what seemed like an age. The wind banged against the longhouse shutters. "Not even me," Horus whispered. Loken sensed a terrible hurt in his commander, a wounded pride that he, even he, had not been worthy enough to know this secret. In a second, the War Master was smiling at Loken again, his dark mood forgotten. "He didn't want to burden me," he said briskly, "but I'm not a fool. I can speculate. As I said, the Imperium would not exist but for the warp. We are obliged to use it, but we know perilously little about it. I believe that I am War Master because the Emperor is occupied in unlocking its secrets. He has committed his great mind to the ultimate mastery of the warp. He has realized that without full understanding of the Immaterium, we will founder and fall, no matter how many worlds we conquer." "What if he fails?" Logan asked. "He won't," the War Master replied bluntly.